is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You've got the latest Peter B. Collins podcast, and I'm glad you're listening to it. My thanks to listeners who support this program, including Kathleen Lowy, Patricia Player, Janet Price, and Jeffrey Adair. If you're able and you'd like to help, I'd appreciate it. I pay the bills myself, except when people support us. You can take out a voluntary subscription as low as $5 a month. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Today, another installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted with Sabelle Edmonds. And today, you're going to meet a Lebanese-American named Nada Prouty. She first went to the FBI, then worked for the CIA. She has quite a story to tell, serving in Iraq while pregnant, and then being bounced from her job for apparently political reasons, but based on a sham marriage that she entered into to get U.S. residency. Share this story far and wide with your friends, and thanks for listening.
Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Our guest today is Nada Prouty, who worked for the Federal Bureau of Investigation and for the Central Intelligence Agency. And she lost her position with the U.S. government after an investigation, and we'll get into the details of that during our conversation. Her new book will be out on November 8, entitled Uncompromised, subtitled The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of an Arab-American Patriot in the CIA. Nada Prouty, welcome to our program today.
Thank you for having me.
And first of all, I want to tell you that I have a certain identity with you because I've been involved with a woman for a long time who is a Lebanese-American from Detroit. And you emigrated from Lebanon at the age of 19. Tell us what it was like to come to this country and what ultimately led you to seek a job with the FBI?
Absolutely. Well, I came to the States in 1989. I was escaping the war-torn country of Lebanon, and I was also escaping an arranged marriage that my father had planned for me. And I had been attending the American University of Beirut, but because of the last round of bombing in 1989, the university had closed. And so I had applied for a student visa and was accepted at Detroit College of Business. came to the States at that time.
And there are many, many Lebanese Americans in Detroit. Dearborn is a center of Arab culture in the United States. And tell us a little bit, because this will come out later, but you decided that you needed to do something in order to get a green card, a resident alien card here in the U.S.
Yes, absolutely. Without the support of my parents, I was forced to work several menial jobs. But with the foreign student tuition, I was unable to afford my very expensive college tuition. And when you are among a big immigrant community, you kind of listen to the advice, whether it's good advice or bad advice. And I was told that you can reduce your student tuition by marrying a United States citizen.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware how grave these the steps that I took. I knew it was wrong, but I wasn't 100% aware of that it was a felony, considered a felony crime by the INS or DHS standards. And therefore, I engaged in a sham marriage. Had I known that as a refugee, if I may use that term, coming from a country torn by war, that I would have probably been eligible for the political asylum process, I would have done that. But I wasn't aware of my choices at the time,
mm-hmm.
and I engaged in an arranged marriage.
All right. And you're not the first or the last to have married in order to get residency in this country. Then, you know, understanding that as your motivation, what led you to seek a job at the FBI?
My college professor had told me that given my accounting degree and my language, that I would be a valuable asset for the FBI. And I also had, by that time, going to school to get my master's degree, I had gained an appreciation for the American culture, the democracy, the freedoms, and I wanted to give something back to the country that took me in.
Mm-hmm. And so you went to work for the FBI, and during that time, you worked on the investigation of the Al-Qaeda attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. You worked on the Khobar Towers investigation in Saudi Arabia, and I believe that's you were also with the FBI when you were assigned in Pakistan, or was that after you shifted to the CIA?
No, that was when I was in the FBI. The one thing, if I may back up, Peter,
uh-huh.
is I do want to mention that when I did apply for the FBI, I listed my first marriage on the first page of my FBI application. And I followed that up with a phone call. I tried to discuss the circumstances of that marriage, and I was told that I should not worry about it. And I just wanted to mention that.
Okay, now there, just so I can be clear, are you referring to your arranged marriage in Lebanon or your sham marriage in the United States?
I am referring to my arranged marriage in the United States, the sham marriage.
Okay. Okay, so, but that was, and I'm sorry, I'm not keeping score here, but that was your second marriage.
No, I was not married in Lebanon.
Oh.
I had escaped the arranged marriage in Lebanon.
I see. Okay.
Correct. And when I first came in here to the States, I was involved in the sham marriage.
Okay. And so then why did you move from the FBI to the CIA in about 2003? Were you recruited, or did you apply for a position at the CIA based on your experience in investigating terrorism at the FBI?
As you mentioned, I had was assigned a number of high-profile cases, and I was assigned to an international terrorism squad, and I worked a lot of the cases overseas. This had exposed me to a lot of CIA officers, and I found that the value where I could provide most for my country was with the CIA. I did not believe that the FBI valued the cultural elements that agents or support personnel bring to the table. In fact, it's my belief that they devalued these cultural experiences, and therefore I thought it is I could provide a lot more to my country based on my cultural background and experiences at the CIA.
Well, let me quiz you about that, because you would have worked with Ali Soufan on the coal investigation. And he's recently been in the news, published a book, had a big battle with the agency over what he was able to disclose, some of it rather ridiculous in my view. But Ali Soufan paints the picture that the FBI was the organization that worked inside the Constitution and inside the law, and it was the CIA that was pushing the limits, including the use of torture. Despite the prohibition by U.S. law, and of course following the tragicomic efforts of John Yoo to redefine torture in order to be able to use torture and say we don't violate the laws on torture. So when we talk about the cultures, comparing the FBI with the CIA, your idea that there was greater cultural sensitivity at CIA doesn't square with what Ali Soufan says.
Well, I think we're talking about two different things here. In my experience at the FBI, the agents that had a diverse background were treated a little bit differently than agents who were born in the U.S. and have not been exposed to the overseas to the overseas culture. And I personally felt that at the office where I was assigned, at the Washington field office. And what you were alluding to was the differences between operating outside the United States with these enhanced interrogation techniques that the Department of Justice had permitted. Now, I personally do not believe that these techniques should be used. It's a reflection on us as Americans, and this is not who we are. But again, I was referring to the cultural elements within the FBI.
Okay, I understand.
Oh, Nada, as far as both the CIA and serving the country goes, let's look at it from two perspectives. From perspectives of, because like you, I came here in 1988 and I lived in war-torn countries. I lived in Iran and Turkey and Azerbaijan. From a person from that perspective, from that background perspective, well, we always, and when I say we, the majority of the people, and not these people are not terrorists, as you know. I mean, these are the people who have been either fighting against the terrorists or the dictatorships and monarchies planted there by, unfortunately, U.S. foreign policies like Shah's regime or the military regime in Turkey by a military coup in 1981. So we always looked at the CIA as the really bad guys. You know, my father, he was a surgeon, and he was tortured by the SAVAK during Shah's regime. And those SAVAK personnel, the agents who tortured my father in return, they were trained by the CIA people that were being sent to Iran during Shah's regime to teach them these enhanced interrogation techniques, including pulling nails and torturing people. So as a person from that perspective, where I grew up, it was an awful, evil agency. And then after I came here in this country and after what we have seen, especially mostly since 2000, although when we look at the past, we are looking at the CIA, whose operation is either secret or when it leaks, it's nothing but criminal, awful stuff, whether it's assassination or torture or black ops or dealing in drugs. I mean, we are talking about the CIA and the Iran-Contras. We are talking about CIA and the heroin dealings in 1980s in Afghanistan. I have never come across any information that says at any given time there was any indication that in any way CIA served the United States interests or did something positive, even from the perspective of an American who has been reading and studying, who has had many CIA sources. It's been nothing but negative. So I'm still trying to figure out, when you say you decided to move from the FBI to the CIA, what was the appeal, both from the perspective of your background, being the recipients of CIA's atrocities committed around the world, but also from the perspective as an American who loves the United States and against these awful practices, including the kidnapping, assassination, tortures, and drug running?
The appeal was the value that the CIA had put on cultural understanding. That is where I saw that I could provide, on the linguistics abilities, that's where I saw I could provide more for my country. I mean, I've in the Bureau, looking at linguists, they are treated, I believe, as second-class citizens. The linguists, which are sometimes great individuals that could run the show, are treated as second-class citizens. Now, having worked with the agency overseas, having been exposed to operations with the agency overseas, I was attracted to the positives of what I saw at the agency, and that's where I wanted to provide. That's where I thought my linguistics, my cultural background, my ability to work in an environment overseas, I could maximize my efforts to help my country.
Oh, there's one point I completely agree with you, and that is the treatment of the FBI when it comes to the language specialist and analyst with linguistic okay. abilities, and not appreciating that as being one of the key factors determining, the course of investigations when you are dealing with the foreign nations and foreign groups, whether criminal or terrorist. You're absolutely right. Well, given the circumstances, it would be different. For example, we have lots of CIA whistleblowers who are CIA analysts, you know, from Ray McGovern to Melvin Goodman. And so there are positions as analysts, and there are analysts, and then there are positions as linguists. But then it becomes a different ball game when we are talking about position of being the operative agents out there on the ground. So if that was the case, was it by choice that you wanted to be a field agent operative versus being an analyst and a language specialist and bringing those abilities into work for the agency and also for the U.S.?
I was a special agent with the FBI, so I hadn't faced so much of that class culture, if I may use that term. But because I worked on an international terrorism squad, I spent most of my time overseas investigating crimes. As an example, the last case that was assigned to me was the assassination of U.S. aid diplomat Lawrence Foley in October of 2002. And in order to conduct that investigation, I interviewed the murderer himself and was able to obtain a confession with the help of the Jordanian service. And I had come to the point where it was jumping through one loophole after the other in order to gain justice for the families of the victims with the Bureau. And my experience with the agency is you could be on the ground. You don't have to wait for incidents to happen to come after the fact and investigate a crime. I wanted to join what I viewed the team that prevented a crime. I wanted to collect intelligence that would prevent a crime vice come and investigate a crime after it had taken place. And when I worked for the agency in Baghdad, the types of intelligence that I was able to gather is attacks on our troops, and being able to gather such information and warn our troops not to travel on a certain route or a certain day, being able to save lives in that sense, that was the attraction to me for joining the agency.
And this is the CIA. But again, I don't want to sound like I'm playing the devil's advocate, but saving lives goes both ways, and that's saving lives everywhere and saving innocent lives everywhere, whether it's U.S. or elsewhere. And I was both appalled and surprised that we didn't have hundreds, if not tens of CIA operatives resigning, quitting, coming out when all these, again, wrongdoings is really putting it mildly, I would say criminal deeds by the CIA when it comes, again, to torture, to secret assassinations, to kidnapping, to these black sites all over the world. And yet we have had so many whistleblowers coming out of the FBI, but we didn't have any really real whistleblowers or even mass resignations from the CIA, from the people who were told to go and torture and kill. And I'm not talking about enemies. As we came to find out, both with the Guantanamo inmates, but with all the cases that now they're coming into light, we found out that most of these people were not guilty of anything. They were innocent people. And yet torture and murder was rampant by the CIA. And how come we didn't have agents walking out, resigning, saying, you know, I love my country. I love the United States and its constitution and its respect, the people's respect for the human rights. We don't allow those things here. And we are not going to participate in any of these criminal, awful practices in the name of our people in the United States and on their behalf. And it's not on their behalf. It's their against, because with every one of these innocent people we torture and kill, we are creating hundreds of more terrorists who have now the motivation and reasons to come after our people. Why do you think we didn't see that with the CIA? Where are those resignations? I mean, why that didn't happen with the CIA when we had so many stuff happening with the, let's say, the FAA, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI, but we didn't have these mass agents resigning in mass resignation and walking out saying, we're not going to engage in this, because these practices, in fact, endanger American people's lives. Why do you think that is?
Well, I agree with you. I personally do not believe that torture is the way to go when obtaining information. Having said that, my experience at the agency has not been with that behavior, and I would not, I would not be involved in such behavior. I can't speak for the folks why they haven't left or why they haven't spoken out. And what I could speak is of my experience and what attracted me to the agency and what the in general, what type of work I have done. And as I allude to in my book, there are bad apples in every agency, and they shouldn't reflect on the whole entire work of the FBI or of the Department of Justice or of the CIA. These few bad apples give the whole entire place a bad name. And I think it's part of that, because I do believe that there are a lot of good people that work at the agency. I do believe a lot of good people work at the FBI. But we also, I mean, you can't escape it. Everywhere you go, you're going to have some bad apples in such big bureaucratic organizations.
I completely agree with you with the notion of bad apples. I mean, with my own experience with the FBI, they were few, those bad apples. They were mainly in the SES, the senior executive level positions. And I rarely come across bad apples against the agents. As far as those agents that I worked with or I got to know, I mean, as far as those people were concerned, these were really hardworking in the FBI, you know, really great men and women. And the practices by these bad apples actually, and I agree with this notion, as far as these agencies are concerned, such as the FBI and the Justice Department, to give the bad names, because we never hold those people who are the bad apples accountable, and
exactly.
It reflects badly on the entire FBI. The only problem I have with the CIA as the only agencies, of course, there are some other black op intel agencies under the Defense Department, such as DIA, but with the CIA is I have never come across good apples as far as the agents or cases go. Again, granted, I know a lot of operations and the things that are being done, again, on our behalf, they are secret, but a lot has come public. As you know, things leak, and we have had, you know, scandals after scandals. I just have never heard of a good apple with the CIA. And again, I'm not going to apply that to the linguist or analyst, people who gather, you know, who get the intelligence, they process it, and I'm not talking about those. As far as the agents are concerned out there, I have never heard, and I have been dealing with nothing but intelligence since 2001, whether it's through National Security Whistleblowers Coalition or other sources or all the books that I have been reading. I have never come across a good apple when it comes to CIA agents. And that is the dilemma that I'm trying to answer. Well, if they're doing all this bad, I mean, why do they even exist and create terrorism for the United States, because these practices, I know for a fact that whether it's in Iran, that's what changes the public opinion and people there when they say, my God, you know, they look at some hypocrisy-ridden foreign policy of the United States, starting, let's say, way back when during Kissinger's time, and they see CIA. And those bad apples, meaning the CIA and those hypocrisy-ridden foreign policies, unfortunately reflect bad for the United States, the people, and then they end up being jumbled up in the same bad apple sack. So if the CIA is such a bad apple case, or maybe I'm wrong, correct me, what can we point out and say these are the cases of actually a few good apples in the CIA, if they exist, that is?
Unfortunately, you know, as part of how the CIA is formed, you can't discuss operations, and so the good is not advertised, but a lot of the bad is advertised. And I do hope that you consider me a good apple, having worked for the CIA. But I do want to address something that you had mentioned. It's accountability, and I completely agree with you, Sybil, here, that there is no accountability for making mistakes. I experienced that in the FBI as an example. The class following my class at the FBI Academy had an agent that was Muslim. I won't say from which country he's from, but during the last few weeks of his training sessions, he was pulled in. His personal computer was taken, and he was investigated. He later learned that his roommate, who didn't understand him culturally and who turned him down for several trips to the FBI bar inside the academy for beers after classes, he reported that he was suspicious and that the roommate had thought that this Muslim agent was recording secret information on his laptop. Well, the FBI did investigate him. They looked into his computer, and he was just simply keeping, which is completely allowed, he was simply keeping a diary of his experiences at the academy. This agent ended up being assigned at the Washington field office. And sometime after September 11th, someone had also reported the same agent that he is sympathizing with the 9/11 hijackers. And I had the opportunity to speak with him again. And when I asked him, where do you think that came from, he told me it was a statement that he was making. We should be careful. We don't want another 9/11 to happen. And he was emotional about it, and someone had misinterpreted. Once again, he was investigated, and he was on administrative leave and cleared for the second time. Now, you ask what happened to the agent that was in his roommate at the academy, and you ask what happened to the agent that was at the Washington field office. And it's plain and simple. Nothing happened. So this is where I personally have a problem. No, the lack of accountability. You can throw dispersions. You can accuse others of being sympathizers with terrorists, but you are not held accountable for what you say. And, of course, that promotes a negative environment. It promotes this two classes. The agents with a foreign background are looked upon differently than agents who are born and raised in the United States.
And that influenced the prosecution of Nada Prouty, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But Nada, Sybil, the discussion of good apples and bad apples led me to think about Apple computers. And to me, it's not an issue of one or two good people or bad people. It's that the operating system has been changed. And the Directorate of Operations at the CIA is really an arm of the military now. It is aggressively conducting what are considered to be secret wars, but they're not so secret. And let me just not offer one example, because I don't want to get too sidetracked by this, but unmanned aerial drones, which are conducted by the CIA as well as the military, But it's the CIA that's been responsible for the drone strikes that are unauthorized in Pakistan. And I believe that these are counterproductive, and that while we historically can establish that we've taken out some key al-Qaeda figures and others who are alleged terrorists, that and that we've done so without loss of American lives, that we are often settling scores for the people who provided us with the intelligence, and that the damage, the death and mayhem caused to civilians, the so-called collateral damage, is extremely costly in an intangible way. So my beef is not with individuals who work for the CIA per se, it's with the policies and the direction that have been in place since 9/11, if not before.
Yes, I understand your point. You make a good point here, and I am troubled by having lives of children, the lives of innocent people being taken away in what you are referring to here, and I personally do not agree with that. With that certain type of program.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I want to turn to the events that happened to you and that you detail in your forthcoming book called Uncompromised, because you disclosed to us earlier in the interview that you engaged in a sham marriage with a man named Shaheen in order to get your resident status here in the United States. And it turns out that you acquired a brother-in-law through this process, and that he became a suspect of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Detroit, that they alleged that he was a sympathizer or had provided so-called material support to Hezbollah. Why don't you pick up the story from there about how this investigation into your, kind of phony brother-in-law led them to prosecute you?
Yes, absolutely. The name of the person, just to clarify here, just the name of the person that I engage in that marriage with is Christopher. And what I acquired a brother-in-law with in the name, the last name is Shaheen.
Okay,
but,
thank you.
The Detroit prosecutors were looking for what I believe some terrorism statistics. And my brother had become an informant for the Bureau, reporting on our brother-in-law due to a family dispute. And one of the things that my brother-in-law was doing is evading taxes and from his successful chain of Lebanese food restaurants. And so they were looking into him and how he was evading taxes, and nothing came up the investigation into whether he had any relations with the terrorist groups. And I think they hit a dead end, and I think they just wanted more statistics. I also believe that the United States attorney at the time, who had twice unsuccessfully was looking for judicial appointment, wanted some media coverage. And so because of his case, they tied me down. They tied me to him and had put all kinds of pressures, which I can go through the details if you're interested, for me to take a plea deal that would give them this publicity. And based on my case, he was appointed as a federal judge at the U.S. District Court in Eastern District of Michigan.
Well, we see that quite a bit, don't we? That those who participate in government cover-ups, in the misguided prosecution of whistleblowers, and other events often get promoted. Just coming back to the Operations Directorate at the CIA, Ali Soufan and the recently released interview with Richard Clark indicate that Tom Wilshire and Rich Blee, both high-level CIA officials, they got promoted despite the fact that they withheld critical intelligence about the 9/11 hijackers from Richard Clark, from the FBI, and presumably from White House officials. So we see that happening quite a bit. Now, do tell us briefly, Nada, about the tactics that they used against you in order to intimidate you into accepting a deal.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it was a range of tactics. I've never seen these kinds of, having worked with assistant United States attorneys and prosecuting real terrorism cases, I've never seen such tactics being used. And you name it, and it was there, from threatening family members to freezing our bank accounts, to putting pressure on me. My husband is a government employee, and they were alluding and hinting that they would go after him, to the final threat, actually, was the most interesting threat, and it was they would seek to deport me to Lebanon and announce, like they did, to the media that I was an employee of the FBI and the CIA, mm-hmm. which I'm sure, if you know, that is equivalent to a death sentence.
Yes.
So with all these pressures, I had to make a decision whether I would take a plea deal or I would fight it. I did not have the financial means. As a government employee, I'm not a rich person. I did not have the financial means to keep fighting it. The other tactic, the typical tactic of draining your financial resources, this whole witch hunt started in 2006. And it was not, it was year after year of paying an attorney to help me figure out this process.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, taking the into account that I'm a national security worker, I worked for the agency, I have no means of defending myself. The evidence that would clear me is in their hands, but they refuse to share the evidence. So with all these tactics and the threats of, they had threatened me that they would charge me for a felony every time I used my U.S. passport for missions that the government had sent me on. And with every single time that I've cashed a paycheck, would be considered a felony because my passport has been obtained illegally through the sham marriage. So with all these threats, I made the decision to lose the battle and hopefully win the war and be able to speak about my case in the future to folks like yourself and to other members of the media.
And let's just clarify here. You voluntarily waived your rights under the statute of limitations. The clock had run on the citizenship issue, yet you waived that because you were being a good citizen and you thought that that would be returned in kind. Am I interpreting that right?
Well, that was part of the plea deal. I waived that because I wanted to live. I had a child at the time. And deporting me to Lebanon and informing the Lebanese government that I was a USG employee meant my death sentence. So I have a mother of a young child. I had to make a decision whether I would take the plea deal, which meant waiving the statute of limitation on this marriage 20 years ago. And I took that plea deal.
Nada, you and I had gone through, you both actually have gone through some really awful stuff. Like you, the FBI came and they collected my home computer, my husband's home computer, the polygraph, and all those things that I believe you went through, correct?
Correct.
And I think for you, it was even harder because at the time when I was going through these torturous, both retaliations and witch hunts, I had not become a mother yet. I didn't have any children. But you went through all this when you just had your baby, correct?
Yes, I had a young child.
And how did you deal with all the stress, with everything, both, you know, as a mother? I mean, here, you know, because I know what happens. You can't sleep. They come and they do this. You're under tremendous pressure and stress. And how did you even deal with it?
Yes. Well, there is something that I truly believe in. I was raised with an abusive parent, and there is one thing that I know about myself. I do have the will to survive. And with all these dark nights, I knew that I needed to survive. If nothing, it's for my child. She became the reason why I wanted to fight this. Because there were some dark nights there, and there were some dark days that I said, you know what, deport me to Lebanon. I'll have to deal with the torture in Lebanon by these terrorist organizations. And, of course, they did not take into consideration with having worked for both of these agencies. All, if they deported me to Lebanon, all the counterintelligence problems that they would face. But nonetheless, I made all these decisions as a mother, and I needed to be strong for my daughter. And I found strength looking at my daughter and knowing that I need to give her a better future than the one I had.
I know you got some support from the CIA during your ordeal. On your website, we will publish the link to your upcoming book so people can read the reviews there. We will also provide a link to your website where they can see background information, et cetera, that you have up there on your experience. But I see there are several letters there from high-level CIA officials, but also your former coworkers, who tried to be supportive and put in a good word with the court, with the judge there. Now, with all that, would you consider going back again and working for either one of these agencies, either the FBI or the CIA?
I love my country, and I would do anything for my country. But I have this fear that it may happen again. With the lack of accountability, anyone can accuse you of anything. They can put pressure on you and force you to take a plea deal. Until some of these measures have been addressed, then I have a fear. As I told you earlier in our interview that I worked in Baghdad, I have been shot at not once, not twice, but several times. And I would have taken a bullet. I was 8 months pregnant in Baghdad, and I would have taken a bullet in defense of my country. But when you have these bad elements within the Department of Justice who could turn the truth and basically threaten you with a death sentence if you didn't take their plea deal, and without having any accountability or an address of these issues, I have a hard time with that myself.
But Nada, let me interject here, because there is a very clear irony here that you are a victim of the very system that you believe you are dedicated to preserve. And your case resulted in a conviction on a very minor charge, an alleged misuse of a FBI computer. That's similar to what they did to Thomas Drake, the NSA whistleblower. They drained him financially by threatening a massive prosecution, and ultimately they settled rather than put him through the process that you endured, which was one of these Kafkaesque trials with secret evidence. And your case is similar to Julia Davis, who's been on the Boiling Frogs, who was working as a mid-level official for the Department of Homeland Security. And when she embarrassed her superiors by trying to do her job and report what she saw as a serious threat, they threw everything at her, including Black Hawk helicopters with 28, SWAT-suited assault weapons-bearing goons. And so I have to ask you to reflect on your work for the very government that has treated you so shabbily.
Yes, Peter, you hit this right on the head. And I'll have to say that I am familiar with both the cases that you've mentioned, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Brian Kelly case that the FBI had fought. He was the spy working for the Russians before they discovered that it was Hansen who was doing all these nasty spying. But yes, I'm familiar with both these cases, and I'd have to say that once you sign on the dotted line, once you raise your hand and you say, I will defend my country from foreign enemies, the question is, who will stand up for you? Why are some people left as victims and thrown out after they have proven themselves to be good employees, someone like Sybil, after they've proven themselves to, after basically being innocent? Why would Drake have to take such a misdemeanor count, and why do we have to spend so much money on investigating these things? And who foots the bill? Another case that comes to mind is the Stephen Hatfield case, mm-hmm. the anthrax. He was initially suspected by the FBI to be the person behind the anthrax attacks. I remember being in the Washington field office and speaking to an agent working on that squad, and I remember being told, we're going to make his life a living hell until he admits he did it. And as you now know, he was paid, he settled in a lawsuit against the FBI in the amount of millions of dollars, I don't recall the number. But who fits the bill? Who pays for these mistakes? It is you, me, and it's the taxpayer who fits these bills.
Well, and Nada, I would argue that we can never compensate you for what you've been through. And I respect the service that you gave our country, and I thank you for it as an American citizen. At the same time, I feel like in some ways there's a duality here that you're willing to accept what they did to you as part of a compromise for what you consider to be the larger security issues.
Well, I do not agree with what they did to me. And if they had, having conducted investigations myself in the past, if you had suspicions or if you had any form, you would just follow the standard operating procedures. And that was not followed. They accused me of viewing documents, but they would never show me what the documents are. And so when they discussed some of the documents and I was able to explain them, they stopped talking about the documents. And I don't agree with what and how I have been treated. I obviously don't agree. And I hope it's in the bottom of the heart. I believe in the United States. I believe in my country. And I hope that we are heading to a place where people are just following the Constitution. You're innocent until proven guilty. Not you're guilty and we're going to find some law or some charge where we can charge you with. That I do not agree with. And I hope that the citizens in the United States are not manipulated by these elements and using fear, the fear tactics, where you would manipulate the citizens to agree with certain programs or certain things that the U.S. government is engaged in. Having grown up in Lebanon, I am aware of these fear tactics. You would see neighbors fighting with each other for whatever reason, and then one neighbor kills the other and tells everybody, oh, this is an agent of Israel. Everybody accepts that. Nobody asks questions. And I'm afraid that we're heading somewhat towards that, where Nada Prouty is guilty because we'll just leak some information to the media, give the impression to people that she had cooperated with terrorists, and that's it. There's no due process. None of these basic elements of investigations are taken into consideration. And at the end of the day, I see a lot of that. I see politics, and I see a lot of these tactics being used against innocent citizens, and I have trouble with that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and let me just briefly summarize that after the CIA essentially exonerated you, on charges of misusing classified material and the larger issue of your patriotism and whether you were some sort of a double agent. The U.S. attorney in Detroit went after you in the media, and they used the media to describe you, quote, hard to imagine that you were greater than the rest in terms of your culpability, that you were an illegal alien who had infiltrated the CIA, that you were guilty of espionage. And ultimately, you won. You were exonerated in court. The judge blasted the U.S. attorney, but he nonetheless revoked your citizenship, fined you just under $1,000, and did block your deportation. But as we look at this, Nada, I can't find a single case of domestic terrorism prosecution. The Lackawanna Six, the Lodi Mosque case here in California, the people in Miami who had a paid FBI informant, getting them to take a pledge to Osama and plan to blow up the Sears Tower. These are government-constructed provocations, and these are part and parcel of the agencies that you worked for and appear to continue to have some respect for.
I do have respect for the men and women who believe in the country, who believe in the Constitution, that work for these agencies. And you hit on a very good point here, Peter. This bait and switch where you'd send an informant and you would ask this informant to manipulate recordings and confess to disliking the American government and then prosecuting this individual for statements that the informant had fed them, I see this as a very short-sighted way to combat terrorism, domestic terrorism.
Well, that's a little too polite, Nada. It's unconstitutional. It's the generation of a police state that is far, you know, far too similar with the tactics of the KGB, which we deplored all through the Cold War.
Yes, I agree with you. This is not something that our Constitution supports. But where do we? How do we get the citizens to be involved in looking at this and making a difference? And you know, using media, alerting the citizens, making them aware of these things, so that the citizens, who are the voters who put people in office, can have a say in these matters. And that's a very alarming way that I see it has been happening for quite some time, and I've seen, you've mentioned all these prosecutions, and I go back and I look at them to see what the latest update on these things, and it's usually someone pleads guilty to some misdemeanor or something completely different from what, or some immigration violation or something of the sort. And I agree with you, Peter. I am alarmed by these types of prosecutions and targeting of citizens just to gain statistics and playing on the minds of citizens, the fear campaign that we've spread after the September 11 attacks.
I have two comments for both you, Peter, and Nada to take from these two comments and continue quickly. I'll make them. One is, Nada, you mentioned that you know, you have the duty to protect this country and Constitution against the foreign enemies. Our oath of office and also our citizenship oath, you took it and I took it in order to become a U.S. citizen, is that we protect the Constitution of the United States against the foreign enemies and the domestic enemies. And we have never had any terrorists that have in any way threatened the United States Constitution. And just the opposite, the threats to our constitutions and the assaults have been coming from our own government, whether it has been the White House or the Pentagon or the CIA, or in some cases, of course, the FBI or Department of Homeland Security, you just name it. So that's one comment for you guys to take on. And the second one has to do with another thing you mentioned with your experience in Iraq and taking the bullet, you know, for our country. I just want to remind us and our listeners that we were the aggressors in Iraq. We were not the good guys. We have never been the good guys. We invaded their country. Therefore, they were defending their country against us. They didn't come. Nobody came here from Iraq in any way threatening our citizens' life or the Constitution. And as we found out, the Saddam regime never had any WMD. And we had people from the CIA and our military there on the ground as foreigners raping their sovereignty and invading their nation. And they have every single right to pour bullets on us because they don't want us there. And I just want to make that comment and make it clear because I believe to this day we still have maybe 50-60% of the people thinking that why these people are attacking us there instead of asking and saying why are we there invading their country? We are the aggressors. We are the enemy. We are in their turf. This is our country, and there has been no Iraqi in this country attacking us. We have never been threatened by Iraq. And I just wanted to clarify that and also get your comments on that.
Yes, absolutely. Let me start by saying this. I feel like I was fooled. When I signed up to go and serve in Iraq, it was because I believed what then Secretary of State Colin Powell had said in his UN Assembly speech. I believed that Iraqis had WMD and had a relationship with Al-Qaeda. I signed up because I wanted to have a better future for my future children, and that is the reason why I signed up. Well, when we got there, and now we know the story, there has not been a WMD program, and there has not been a solid relationship with Al-Qaeda like we were told. I felt fooled, and at that time, I had to make a decision. Either our soldiers were there, their life was in danger, and I can contribute to saving their lives by collecting intelligence, not from the innocent Iraqi citizens, but these, I'm talking about groups, terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, who were trying to harm our soldiers.
And you will acknowledge that Al-Qaeda wasn't in Iraq before we invaded.
Right. Yeah. But we have created a safe haven for them. So they flooded into Iraq when we destabilized the country. And now we have a situation on our hand. We have troops that we know that their life are in danger. And my mission had completely 180% changed here. I had to make the decision, and I made the decision to stay and collect intelligence that would save the troops' lives. And again, it wasn't from the innocent Iraqi citizens. I also, the intelligence that I gathered also helped save the innocent Iraqi citizens' lives. Just to clarify that, I do feel like I was fooled. I believed what I was told, and I went to serve there based on that belief, and it wasn't there. But again, I wasn't going to turn my back on the troops and say, I'm shipping out of here. I knew what my contributions were, and I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to save these young men that stood out there to guard us or were out on the streets on their separate missions. And this is why I stayed, and that's the type of intelligence that I was collecting. And so I agree with you there, Sybil. I'm glad that you brought this up. It clarified the point that I was trying to make.
I also...
Thank you for admitting to it, and thank you for clarifying for us in terms of where you stand, because that will also clarify the things for our listeners. Thank you.
Nada Prouty, thank you for joining us today. The new book will be out in early November, Uncompromised, subtitled The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of an Arab-American Patriot in the CIA.
Thank you.
Great to have you, Nada.
Give me absolute control over every living soul in that sanity.
take the only tree that's left, stuffed it up the hole in your culture. Give me the back of Berlin Wall, give me a style and say, Paul, I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews. Until